Hello, everyone. Hallo. Ihr hört das Freifunkradio. You're listening to Freifunkradio. Now, today we're going to broadcast in English because this is a pre-production from the Wireless Community Weekend. And we have a guest from the United States, from New York City. Zach is with us from New York City Wireless.
Hello, hello. Zach Giles from New York City. New York City Mesh.
Yeah, it's great to have you here, and one of the rare opportunities to talk to someone from over the ocean. And yes, maybe we mostly start when we're talking with communities. What's the state of your community? How many devices, routers, nodes do you have deployed, and so on?
Yeah, our network is quite large now. It covers a large portion of southern Manhattan, which is kind of the main island in New York City. And then we cover, I don't know, maybe half of Brooklyn. And we've also jumped up to the Upper West Side in New York City and all the way up to the Bronx. And that's kind of important because we've had a goal of getting to the Bronx for quite a while because it's sort of much more low income and generally. And it's generally kind of a, we want to be of use to people in the area. So we're serving everybody, you know, the rich and the poor, but we want to make sure that we also make the network available in low-income areas. So yeah, we have maybe 3,000 to 5,000 people using it daily. Mm-hmm. We don't really know how many people because we don't track the people. We push through maybe about 4 or 5 gigabits in the evening time continuously out of the network. We're in about 800 buildings, which is pretty big. Mm-hmm. I think, and I don't know, a couple thousand. We have about 2,600 routes in our routing table, so the route is roughly a, like a building or a router that has a subnetwork on mm-hmm. it. So we probably have around 2,000 devices. I don't really know at the moment how many, but we're in about 800 buildings.
Yeah,
it's quite sizable. We also have done fiber to some buildings, about maybe 5 or 6 buildings have fiber to the premise and up the riser and into people's apartments, even some mm-hmm. apartments. Some buildings have all apartments, some have some apartments. But yeah, we're both wireless and wired. It's all nonprofit, donation based still. So yeah, we're
okay.
We're quite big at this point.
So you expanded since we had one of you with us quite a while ago.
I think at this point it was just in Manhattan.
We were always in Brooklyn as well. Our first supernode was in Manhattan and our second supernode was in Brooklyn. Eventually that one went away and our third supernode is also in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. So the bulk of our network is actually in Brooklyn. Most of the high points and the different people who really want to be on the network are in Brooklyn. It kind of works out because Brooklyn has generally shorter buildings, and it's kind of interesting if you think about it. It's like there's mountains and valleys. Some of these networks have like something on a mountaintop, mm-hmm. and then they shoot signals down to a valley. New York City has mountains and valleys as well. The mountains are these high buildings, and the valleys are these neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And so we're kind of limited on being able to go too far north without fiber because there's buildings that are in the way. There's mm-hmm. these giant mountains we can't cross. But in downtown, we can kind of be on a few tall ones and shoot down into the Brooklyn, use some of the housing authority buildings to get up high again, and then shoot down again.
So you're allowed to build nodes on government or city buildings?
Yeah, so we've worked out a couple ways to do it. In New York City, there's an agency called the New York City Housing Authority, and they run kind of low-income housing for rent. They're one of mm-hmm. the biggest landlords in New York City, and it's like a pseudo-government thing. And so we made a deal with them at some point that we could be on certain of their buildings. And we are. We're in about maybe 5 of their buildings. Mm-hmm. Some of those buildings, we also serve the residents down below. Other of the buildings, we're not allowed to for whatever reason. And so we're in a number of their buildings. We're also on Columbia University rooftop. CCNY is like the New York State, one of the colleges. We also have some deals where, I say deals lightly, but we have some situations where there's some regulations that certain building types must provide internet for their residents. They must make it available to the residents. Mm-hmm. And so some of these buildings have asked us to be in the building. And so by doing that, we get on the rooftop as well. And so those are some positive ones for us.
Yeah.
Amazing. And how many volunteers are you?
A few hundred. Yeah, it kind of goes up and down. Yeah. Now, on a daily basis, or on like a, we have a weekly kind of, we have a weekly meetup, if you will. We also have like an office space that we've rented, or kind of a workshop space. It's about the size of this room. And we meet up maybe 20 people per week.
Okay.
If we go on some journey, we'll probably have more people. If we do like one of our monthly bigger meetings, we'll probably have maybe 50.
Okay,
but here and there is 200-ish going on enough.
That are still big numbers.
Amazing numbers.
Yeah. I mean, it's not as much as it could be, but it's, you know, I guess, you know, if you think about one of the challenges of probably every community network is participation, right? You know, what percentage of the users are fully participating. And, you know, for us, it's a very small percentage, but it's still a good number of people.
Yeah, and maybe speaking of technology, what kind of devices and firmwares do you use in your network?
So we used to use the Libre Mesh type firmwares and devices. We've since moved off of that, not because we don't want it, but more because we thought about making a more standards-based approach. So even though OLSR and Batman and BMX, these are all very nice, well-developed protocols, but it means that I can't use a Cisco switch or a Juniper switch if someone gives it to you. And maybe that's good, maybe it's bad, I don't know. So we've decided to go with OSPF. And so we're using OSPF everywhere. There's another network in South Africa that also is using OSPF, and we kind of looked at them and saw how big their network was and thought about it. And there's some things we liked that they did and some things we didn't like what they did. So we took that concept of OSPF and we've kind of tuned OSPF and done some nice things with the costing and the subnetting in order to make it so that, you know, it works in our environment. So we use a lot of MikroTik, even though they're not, you know, open source. One of the big reasons we use MikroTik is because it's very easy for people to understand how to do it. I can teach someone very quickly how to build a node. And we have a configuration generator on our website. You can type in your node number. We assign node numbers, so we can talk about that too. But, you know, you type in a node number and then the type of hardware, the subcategory, the firmware style, where you're going to, you know, how you're going to deploy it. And it will generate you a configuration, which you just send to the device. And there's even like a UI to do that. And you're done. And so this is very helpful for engaging people, and it kind of jumps the hurdle of, you know, how do you do a system image? How do you do a firmware update? You know, where do you click on all these different screens? So MikroTik's not the only one. We also use a lot of point-to-point antennas, including the 2 gigahertz, 5 gigahertz, I mean, sorry, 2 gigabit, 5 gigabit, and 10 gigabit Siklu antennas. We're using Juniper switches, Cisco switches, Linux boxes. We're even using VPP with FRR for edge routing. Yeah.
Okay, so it's a bit of a different approach. I don't know what OSPF means.
Open shortest path first.
Okay.
It's another routing protocol. It's kind of a standard one. It's like a corporate standard one.
It's for wired networks, basically, so you don't have a radio metric. Or did you add a radio metric to OSPF?
We don't have a radio metric, no. So what we did is we made a costing structure. So good costs are for point-to-point links that are on like a really high-quality radio that we know is very unlikely to go down. And then the next level is kind of like our point-to-multipoint, maybe in the 200 cost range or something. And then a poor cost is for the WDS, sort of 802.11s sort of thing. And so we have, I can show you on the map various places where we have nodes that are with an omnidirectional antenna only, but they're on the network using OSPF. So one thing you have to watch out is with route flapping. It's probably the same in OLSR and other things. You know, route flapping. And so we monitor for route flapping periodically and see, you know, how many flaps per second are we getting, how many are per minute, you know, and we go in and fix those nodes. So I think in probably in any protocol, you can have some bad edge cases, and it just OSPF can also, you know.
So you're not necessarily doing any mesh networking, actually. You're setting up point-to-point or point-to-multipoint links.
No, we do with 802.11s. We do WDS, yeah. Yeah, so we have many nodes that are with an omnidirectional only, and they see their neighbors around. Yeah.
And you're not using the radio-aware OLSR part in 802.11s or the spanning tree implementation?
No, you turn it off.
You just use it without the internal mesh routing.
That's right. Yeah, we use it as a broadcast domain only, or like as a kind of like a fake Ethernet cable, you know. And we do bridge filtering, so we turn off all of the. You're not able to go from one node to another node through the radio without going through the router.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you have to jump node to node in order to get to the far side, which means, of course, it's not going to be very efficient to do the WDS, but it's better than nothing for many people.
But my guess is that you don't have too much internal traffic. Most traffic is probably just going to the next gateway, and
unfortunately,
you have
many
gateways.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that's just, you know, over the years we had different internal services. Some went away, some came back. We have a few now. We have kind of databases, and we used to have a chat app inside and things like this, and they come and go depending on what people want to do.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
Of course. Yeah.
What motivates the volunteers to run such a relatively big network?
Yeah.
And basically be just a free internet service provider,
mm-hmm.
more or less?
Yeah, we don't like to say free. We like to say donation-based, because we don't want people to think that they can, you know, if you give somebody something for free, it has no value, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we want them to value the network by, you know, wanting to be part of it.
Mm-hmm.
They can pay nothing if they want to, but, you know, we don't usually say free. But anyway, I don't mind if you say free, you know? but it's just that, yeah, so we what motivates them? You know, in New York City, the ISPs used to be, and sometimes are still, very bad. And so kind of our original motivation was to bypass the ISPs. Also, if you look into what has happened, there's many kiosks on the road that have a Wi-Fi, and many different of the main ISPs have got purchased by other ISPs, and they're all tracking everything. They're all, you know, we were even approached by some company that said they'll give us $1,000 a month if we give them all of our DNS logs forever. And we're like,
okay.
No, we're not going to do that, you know. So, but they're all doing that, and they say they're doing it, and it's kind of evil. So we like it because it's kind of a clear network, which you can have, you know, you can have a public IP, you can have bidirectional traffic. We're bypassing these poor quality ISPs in many cases, where we're sort of better than many of them at different times.
Huh,
in terms of availability.
Sounds a bit like Berlin in the 2000s.
Yeah, sounds
yeah.
like early Berlin.
Yeah, sure.
How does it, why do they suck so badly? How do they mess it up?
So it's a good question, and the story has changed a little bit. So I was kind of telling you more of the story of a handful of years ago. It's still a story now, though. Maybe if you look 10 years ago, a lot of people in 3 to 6 floor buildings only had DSL, right? And the DSL in New York City is from cables that are from long ago. It's not a current maintained system. Verizon, the main telephone company, since the early 2010s, had said they were going to run fiber to every building. And they began running fiber to every building, they say. But it meant that they were no longer going to put any more copper in the ground. And so they basically abandoned the copper plant, even though people were still using it. Meanwhile, the cable company, in the U.S. you usually have two providers. You have the telephone company and the cable company before internet. And now both can provide telephone and internet and TV and everything, right? But still in the regulations, there's two main entities. So the cable company in New York City has been purchased 3 times or more in the last 10 years. It's gone bankrupt and got repurchased and bankrupt and repurchased. And the name keeps changing. I think it's now called Spectrum. It used to be Time Warner. It used to be RCN. And in many areas, the cable infrastructure is very poor. The cables are not dry. They get wet. Coaxial cable gets wet and water inside. People go outside and they kind of like jiggle the cables on the wall because their TV is not working. So the couplers are coming loose. And, you know, many places, I was in at least 2 or 3 places that I lived in, I think 6 or 8 places in New York City in the last many years. And a couple of them, the internet, cable internet was down more often than it was up. I had a friend that had barely 1 megabit DSL, and that was less than 10 years ago.
Okay.
Maybe it's about 10 years ago. So, yeah, it's not great. The story's changed a little bit now because Verizon does have fiber in many buildings, and so you can get a high-quality fiber optic internet for a pretty good price. So in that sense, then it's not as well needed for our network, right? But in many places, it's still very poor.
Mm-hmm. So, and your perspective, if eventually the commercial ISPs get up their gear and put fiber everywhere, what would that mean to your network?
I don't know. You know, on one angle, we could become more of a community ISP that just kind of is for fun, you know, more of a real, true community, as opposed to, you know, trying to serve people with something. We could also be a participant in that. For example, many cities in the U.S. have tried to do kind of a municipal fiber idea, with Chattanooga, Tennessee being like the number one successful option on that. But I think New York City is probably going to try to do that as well. And if we could be one of the providers that is through that, we might have an option for people besides, you know, the main telephone companies. So that makes it a little bit different of a system than what we have. But, you know, you really need to provide whatever that environment needs, whatever that area needs. It's a little bit different than like in a jungle or something like that.
But I guess the problem with families or people with low income still exists, and they maybe still can't afford internet access, and that's where you will still be able to help.
Yeah, about 25% of households only have no internet in them in New York City. Okay. And maybe 15% are mobile only, you know, they only have a cell phone.
25%?
Mm-hmm. 25-26%, yeah.
Yeah. Hard to believe. Mm. It's one of the main capitals of the planet.
Yeah, yeah, it's a problem of aging infrastructure combined with growth, right, and regulation. It's hard to provide new wires in the ground. There's the underground cabling is owned by the telephone company, but it's a subsidiary and so on. There's a lot of things that are very challenging with New York City, which is why we kind of go over the top of it with wires.
So you're not putting wires into the ground?
We don't put wires in the ground. We have some fiber, but we lease fiber, dark fiber, from various friendly companies.
Yeah, so you're releasing it.
Yes.
Okay, but so to the largest part, you're a wireless ISP?
Yes, all wireless, yeah. Oh.
And where do you get your internet uplinks?
It's a good question. We don't pay for any internet. Everything is donated. We have a couple donated 40 gigabit links from a company called Pilot Fiber. They're very nice to us. We also have some dark fiber from them, but they don't charge us for the internet. We also are on a couple internet exchanges, and we have some donated internet from other local companies. So it's all donated. We have about, if you were to use it all at the same time, about 120 gigabits of internet connectivity, and we don't think we can use it all at the moment. But you know, it's wired into our super nodes.
Way cool.
Yeah,
it's really interesting to hear.
There's still a lot of work to do, but you know, we have a lot of resources that are working well, and we found some favorable kind of tier two ISPs that are very friendly to us because they're commercial only, and they don't need any home activity.
Yeah, and. Maybe I think I won't travel to New York City the next two and a half years for reasons. but after that, can I see your SSID and just use it?
Or yeah. We have a open SSID with no password. This SSID restricts some control plane access within our network, so that you can't get on and then access some of the internal control plane pages and such. But there's another one that has a password, which everybody knows, and this is more open. So yeah, everybody can just use it. If you have a wire from the rooftop into your apartment, you can have your own home network with your own whatever, and it's not our problem. You know. But yeah, you can just use it. There's many parks you can just go into and use it. Many of these grounds where we have fiber into the building, we also light up the entire ground with access points. Like many of the buildings are kind of like in a square block, and the building's not a square. So there's like many different pieces of green grass that people go to. Mm. So many parks, we're in a bunch of different parks and such, yeah.
Did you have any legal issues?
Not really, no. We formed a proper nonprofit, so we have all of that. We have a board, you know, we accept donations legally and everything. We file our nonprofit disclosure every year. We do all the right things with that. We're not registered as an ISP. There's a form you put in the FCC. We're not an ISP, and so we're not subject to any of those regulations. once in a while the police will email us and say, can you tell us who this IP belongs to? But we can't because it's all shared. And so we just reply, we're sorry, we can't, we're a shared network. And they say, okay, no problem.
And you're not logging?
We don't log. We don't log anything.
Okay.
That I know of.
If I want to get part of your network, I should come to one of your meetings, or can I just buy a router and install the firmware?
We very much support DIY. You can buy, you can follow our documentation. You can buy the antenna from whoever you want. You could buy whichever model you feel like, and you can go and ask for a node number. We are assigning node numbers. I can talk about why. And then you just type it into the configuration generator. You generate config. You put on the device. And if you are in range of another one that has the same class of antenna, then you're on. Mm-hmm. You can even go point to multipoint with DIY. You don't have to ask us. We welcome you to come to the meeting. We encourage you to come to the meetings. Mm-hmm. We do volunteer-led installations as well. So a team of a few people, one of whom maybe knows more about how to do it, and a couple who know less, they go along and they install your rooftop with the new member. And then the new member also learns how to do it, and the other people are learning how to do it as well. And we have different skills: drilling in the wall, running the cable outside, mm-hmm. clamping things to rooftops, all kinds of different things, right? And so, you can do it yourself, or you can come to a meeting.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's come back to the node number.
Sure. Yeah.
As it was mentioned twice now.
Yeah, sure.
In my home community in Weimar, we also use a construct called node number, and behind that node number, the node number is the basis for calculating IP addresses and configuration and so on. Mm-hmm. And so maybe it's
the same. Yeah. We do that because we don't want to take up the entire 10/8 block, and we also don't want. It could be fine to do it, but we found some trouble with kind of using like the MAC address and then just using these couple hex digits and using that for deriving mm-hmm. something. It becomes very frustrating when you're trying to debug a medium-sized network and you're like, well, where? Well, node FC72 over there, well, they replaced it with something else. It's called something else. You don't really know where it is anymore. And so we use these to generate the IP addresses and such. Makes it very easy for us to maintain mm-hmm. nodes. There's a lot of very predictable numbering that we created within our network. Yeah, the node number is not a big deal. It's very easy. There's a form you can fill out online. You push it, and it just gives you a number immediately, or you can ask someone, mm-hmm. For one.
So in order to join with their own nodes, people just provide an email address so you can contact them, or?
You can fill out the join form. We have a form on our site, and just put in your name and email. You don't have to put in, you can put whatever you feel like. We'd like it to be something. We can call you, something, Bob or whatever, mm-hmm. Something real. And then, because we're not like an anonymous community, like the activity on the network is anonymous, but we want to know we want to meet everybody face to face and become friends, right? You can fill this out, and then it'll give you a number, and you're done. Yeah.
Sounds easy. So.
It should be easy, yeah. I mean, we have many DIY
installations. You make it sound easy.
I make it sound easy, yeah. We have many DIY installations, and it's okay to do that. You can also use your own hardware. If you want to do OpenWRT with whatever on GLINet, and you feel like you can set up OSPF, mm-hmm. get a node number, look at the calculation for how to generate an IP address, put the IPs in, and then go ahead and do it. Yeah.
And a Microsoft...
Microtech?
The Microtech gear, it has OSPF inside by default, so you just run the factory firmware.
Yes, yeah. We found bugs on it, and we reported it to them, and they fixed them. Mm-hmm. We have many thousands of their devices. I'm not sure that they know us very well, but we have
couple
thousand, and they're from Latvia, so they're a European company, and they produce the things pretty well. And they're pretty good product. Everything works. It's very flexible. It's hard to break them. And the nice thing we like is, it'll sound funny to say, but New York City is a bit of a harsh environment because we have a winter and we have a summer, mm-hmm. and we have rain, and we have all these different situations. And sometimes the antennas are on a rooftop where there's people going there and doing different things to it. and maybe installations are done by somebody who didn't know what they were going to do. So, you know, that we like these devices because we're not taking like a Linksys router and put it into a Tupperware and glue it. It's, you know, it's just working. We all did that, I think, in the past, but it's not, you know, that's not as doable on the scale that we have. And so these devices are kind of in like a nice plastic box that goes outside. It already works. And you can give it a bad voltage and it will not break, and you can give it a good voltage and it will has a very high range for voltages and things like that. So there's a lot of positives to it. You can recover them if you brick them somehow. So, yeah.
The plastic doesn't turn brittle in the sun.
It doesn't, no, yeah.
Unlike the Tupperware. So
exactly, yeah, the Tupperware.
Not recommended.
Exactly. Or even better, the Tupperware on top of the pole, right? Oh. duct tape to the pole.
I've seen nanostations operating the wrong way around and filling up with water.
Yeah. Not good.
Yeah. Happens.
Yeah. So that's why we use a lot of Microtech devices. It's easy. Mm-hmm. I have hope that maybe someday more Microtech devices could run OpenWRT or some other open variant. I don't think it's impossible. I just think it's not as easy. Yeah.
You can ask the people upstairs. Yeah. Some OpenWRT developers here.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Do we still have time?
3.5 minutes.
3.5 minutes. Okay. So do we have some real spectacular installations somewhere? Maybe on some real high towers or some telecommunication towers? Or?
Yeah, we have a few. One of our first supernode is on an old Verizon building, which was bought by another company, so it's not Verizon anymore. Mm-hmm. It's, I think, 75 meters high, and there's a scaffolding on top of it. And I used to be the one that climbed the scaffolding.
Okay.
Yeah, it's exciting. yeah, we had, I think, maybe 8 antennas there at some point, and I can show you a picture later. You can see, you know, all of Manhattan. It's a very spectacular building. Mm-hmm. So we, you know, that was one of our first supernodes. We ran some copper to the roof, and then many years later, we replaced it with fiber and DC power. But now all of our supernodes and even our large hubs, which are not super, but they're still, you know, whatever, they're very big hubs, use DC and fiber. So we have another one on top of a housing project. I think it's probably 20 floors high. It's called Vernon. And that one has, I don't know, maybe 8 antennas as well or something. One of our other buildings is called Grand Street. It's for it's a housing project. We have fiber to the building, and it's a 40 gigabit fiber from our data center with a Juniper switch in the maintenance room downstairs. And then we have an OLT serving around up to 600 apartments. I think only maybe 250 are active at the moment, and also fiber to the roof. This one serves many 10 gigabit links, 5 gigabit and 10 gigabit links to other major hubs. And so this is kind of our crown jewel, is the Grand Street location. Mm-hmm. So we're very happy to have a $1 lease there or something, and enjoy the time on the rooftop there. Yeah, so we go there all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds really interesting.
Do you have local internal traffic in the network, except like OSPF updates?
Those don't count, you know. we don't have as much, you know. Many of our users are not as technically savvy. It's a, you know, I think at some point, how many technically savvy people can you have within your city? You know, you can have a large number, but if you want to serve even more people, or you want to, you know, find somebody to use your network, you know, you can't serve an infinite number of technical people, right? And so we have a lot of people. We have, you know, grandmas and, you know, Buddhist monks, and we have families and schools and all kinds of people using the network. There is some east-west traffic within the network. A lot of it goes back to our supernodes, where we host our kind of common services within the data center rack in our supernodes. And so if there is east-west traffic, it's often back to that. Mm-hmm. So this is a thing we strive for, is to have more east-west traffic. Yeah.
That was our 30 minutes.
Okay, no problem.
With
yeah.
Zach.
Yeah.
Hey, thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to talk to you.
Sure, yeah. It was interesting.
Maybe you just send us some pictures. We include them in the show notes.
Oh, yes,
so
in
that
the show
we
notes.
Can okay. Show the people what we were talking about.
Yeah, we can do that. No problem.
Okay.
Bye.
So, thank you. Bye. That was the June episode.
I suppose so.
Yeah.
There you go. Okay. Thanks for doing it.